was surrounded, and Giles had led a team of stragglers to the buffet table in the drawing-room. Frank was out in the drive seeing that people got their cars. I was hemmed in by strangers. "Goodbye, and thanks tremendously. I'm so glad." The great hall began to empty. Already it wore that drab, deserted air of a vanished evening and the dawn of a tired day. There was a grey light on the terrace. I could see the shapes of the blown firework stands taking form on the lawns. "Goodbye. A wonderful party. I'm so glad." Maxim had gone out to join Frank in the drive. Beatrice came up to me, pulling off her jangling bracelets. "I can't stand these things a moment longer. Heavens, I'm dead beat. I don't believe I've missed a dance. Anyway, it was a tremendous success." "Was it?" I said. "My dear, hadn't you better go to bed? You look worn out. You've been standing nearly all the evening. Where are the men?" "Out on the drive. I shall have some coffee and eggs and bacon. What about you?" "No, Beatrice, I don't think I will." "You looked very charming in your blue. Everyone said so, and nobody had an inkling about the other things, so you mustn't worry." "No. If I were you, I should have a good long lie tomorrow morning. Don't attempt to get up. Have your breakfast in bed." "Yes, perhaps." "I'll tell Maxim you've gone up, shall I?"
"Please, Beatrice."
"All right, my dear. Sleep well."
She kissed me swiftly, patting my shoulder at the same time, and then went off to find Giles in the supper room. I walked slowly up the stairs, one step at a time. The band had turned the lights off in the gallery and had gone down to have eggs and bacon too. Pieces of music lay about the floor. One chair had been upturned. There was an ashtray full of the stubs of their cigarettes. The aftermath of the party. I went along the corridor to my room. It was getting lighter every moment, and the birds had started singing. I did not have to turn on the light to undress. A little chill wind blew in from the open window. It was rather cold. Many people must have used the rose garden during the evening, for all the chairs were moved and dragged from their places. There was a tray of empty glasses on one of the tables. Someone had left a bag behind on a chair. I pulled the curtain to darken the room, but the grey morning light found its way through the gaps at the side. I got into bed, my legs very weary, a niggling pain in the small of my back. I lay back and closed my eyes, thankful for the cool white comfort of clean sheets. I wished my mind would rest like my body, relax and pass to sleep, not hum round in the way it did, jigging to music, whirling in a sea of faces. I pressed my hands over my eyes, but they would not go. I wondered how long Maxim would be. The bed beside me looked stark and cold. Soon there would be no shadows in the room at all. The walls and the ceiling and the floor would be white with the morning. The birds would sing their songs, louder, gayer, less subdued. The sun would make a yellow pattern on the curtain. My little bedside clock ticked out the minutes, one by one. The hand moved round the dial. I lay on my side watching it. It came to the hour and passed it again. It started afresh on its journey. But Maxim did not come. Chapter 18. I think I fell asleep a little after 7. It was broad daylight, I remember. There was no longer any pretense that the drawn curtains hid the sun. The light streamed in at the open window and made patterns on the wall. I heard the men below in the rose garden clearing away the tables and the chairs and taking down the chain of fairy lights. Maxim's bed was still bare and empty. I lay across my bed, my arms over my eyes, a strange, mad position and the least likely to bring sleep. But I drifted to the borderline of the unconscious and slipped over it at last. When I awoke, it was past 11, and Clarice must have come in and brought me my tea without my hearing her, for there was a tray by my side and a stone-cold teapot, and my clothes had been tidied, my blue frock put away in the wardrobe. I drank my cold tea, still blurred and stupid from my short, heavy sleep, and stared at the blank wall in front of me. Maxim's empty bed brought me to realization with a queer shock to my heart, and the full anguish of the night before was upon me once again. He had not come to bed at all. His pyjamas lay folded on the turned-down sheet, untouched. I wondered what Clarice had thought when she came into the room with my tea. Had she noticed? Would she have gone out and told the other servants? And would they all discuss it over their breakfast? I wondered why I minded that, and why the thought of the servants talking about it in the kitchen should cause me such distress. It must be that I had a small, mean mind, a conventional, petty hatred of gossip. That was why I had come down last night in my blue dress, and had not stayed hidden in my room. There was nothing brave or fine about it. It was a wretched tribute to convention. I had not come down for Maxim's sake, for Beatrice's, for the sake of Manderley. I had come down because I did not want the people at the ball to think I had quarrelled with Maxim. I didn't want them to go home and say, "Of course, you know, they don't get on. I hear he's not at all happy." I had come for my own sake, my own poor personal pride. As I sipped my cold tea, I thought with a tired, bitter feeling of despair that I would be content to live in one corner of Manderley and Maxim in the other, so long as the outside world should never know. If he had no more tenderness for me, never kissed me again, did not speak to me except on matters of necessity, I believed I could bear it if I were certain that nobody knew of this but our two selves, if we could bribe servants not to tell, play our part before relations, before Beatrice, and then, when we were alone, sit apart in our separate rooms, leading our separate lives. It seemed to me, as I sat there in bed, staring at the wall, at the sunlight coming in at the window, at Maxim's empty bed, that there was nothing quite so shaming, so degrading, as a marriage that had failed. Failed after 3 months, as mine had done, for I had no illusions left now. I no longer made any effort to pretend. Last night had shown me too well. My marriage was a failure. All the things that people would say about it if they knew were true. We did not get on. We were not companions. We were not suited to one another. I was too young for Maxim, too inexperienced, and more important still, I was not of his world. The fact that I loved him in a sick, hurt, desperate way, like a child or a dog, did not matter. It was not the sort of love he needed. He wanted something else that I could not give him, something he had had before. I thought of the youthful, almost hysterical excitement and conceit with which I had gone into this marriage, imagining I would bring happiness to Maxim, who had known much greater happiness before. Even Mrs. Van Hopper, with her cheap views and common outlook, had known I was making a mistake. "I'm afraid you will regret it," she said. "I believe you are making a big mistake." I would not listen to her. I thought her hard and cruel. But she was right. She was right in everything. That last mean thrust thrown at me before she said goodbye. "You don't flatter yourself he's in love with you, do you? He's lonely. He can't bear that great empty house," was the sanest, most truthful statement she had ever made in her life. Maxim was not in love with me. He had never loved me. Our honeymoon in Italy had meant nothing at all to him, nor our living here together. What I had thought was love for me, for myself as a person, was not love. It was just that he was a man, and I was his wife, and was young, and he was lonely. He did not belong to me at all. He belonged to Rebecca. He still thought about Rebecca. He would never love me because of Rebecca. She was in the house still, as Mrs. Danvers had said. She was in that room in the West Wing. She was in the library, in the morning room, in the gallery above the hall, even in the little flower room where her Mackintosh still hung, and in the garden, and in the woods, and down in the stone cottage on the beach. Her footsteps sounded in the corridors. Her scent lingered on the stairs. The servants obeyed her orders still. The food we ate was the food she liked. Her favourite flowers filled the rooms. Her clothes were in the wardrobes in her room. Her brushes were on the table, her shoes beneath the chair, her nightdress on her bed. Rebecca was still mistress of Manderley. Rebecca was still Mrs. de Winter. I had no business here at all. I had come blundering like a poor fool on ground that was preserved. "Where is Rebecca?" Maxim's grandmother had cried. "I want Rebecca. What have you done with Rebecca?" She did not know me. She did not care about me. Why should she? I was a stranger to her. I did not belong to Maxim or to Manderley. And Beatrice, at our first meeting, looking me up and down, frank, direct. You're so very different from Rebecca. Frank, reserved, embarrassed when I spoke of her, hating those questions I had poured upon him, even as I had hated them myself, and then answering that final one as we came towards the house, his voice grave and quiet. Yes, she was the most beautiful creature I have ever seen. Rebecca. Always Rebecca. Wherever I walked in Manderley, wherever I sat, even in my thoughts and in my dreams, I met Rebecca. I knew her figure now, the long slim legs, the small and narrow feet, her shoulders broader than mine, the capable, clever hands, hands that could steer a boat, could hold a horse, hands that arranged flowers, made the models of ships, and wrote Max from Rebecca on the flyleaf of a book. I knew her face too, small and oval, the clear white skin, the cloud of dark hair. I knew the scent she wore. I could guess her laughter and her smile. If I heard it, even among a thousand others, I should recognize her voice. Rebecca. Always Rebecca. I should never be rid of Rebecca. Perhaps I haunted her as she haunted me. She looked down on me from the gallery, as Mrs. Danvers had said. She sat beside me when I wrote my letters at her desk. That mackintosh I wore, that handkerchief I used, they were hers. Perhaps she knew and had seen me take them. Jasper had been her dog, and he ran at my heels now. The roses were hers, and I cut them. Did she resent me and fear me as I resented her? Did she want Maxim alone in the house again? I could fight the living, but I could not fight the dead. If there was some woman in London that Maxim loved, someone he wrote to, visited, dined with, slept with, I could fight with her. We would stand on common ground. I should not be afraid. Anger and jealousy were things that could be conquered. One day the woman would grow old or tired or different, and Maxim would not love her any more. But Rebecca would never grow old. Rebecca would always be the same. And her I could not fight. She was too strong for me. I got out of bed and pulled the curtains. The sun streamed into the room. The men had cleared the mess away from the rose garden. I wondered if people were talking about the ball in the way they do the day after a party.
"Did you think it quite up to their usual standard?"
"Oh, I think so.
The band dragged a bit, I thought.
The supper was damn good. Fireworks weren't bad. B. Lacey is beginning to look old. Who wouldn't in that get-up? I thought he looked rather ill. He always does. What did you think of the bride?" "Not much. Rather dull."
"I wonder if it's a success."
"Yes, I wonder."
Then I noticed, for the first time, there was a note under my door. I went and picked it up. I recognized the square hand of Beatrice. She had scribbled it in pencil after breakfast.
"I knocked at your door but had no answer, so gather you've taken my advice and are sleeping off last night. Giles is anxious to get back early, as they've rung up from home to say he's wanted to take somebody's place in a cricket match and it starts at 2. How he is going to see the ball after all the champagne he put away last night, heaven only knows. I'm feeling a bit weak in the legs, but slept like a top. Frith says Maxim was down to an early breakfast and there's now no sign of him. So please give him our love and many thanks to you both for our evening, which we thoroughly enjoyed. Don't think any more about the dress."
This last was heavily underlined. "Yours affectionately, B." And a postscript. "You must both come over and see us soon." She had scribbled 9:30 a.m. at the top of the paper, and it was now nearly 11:30. They had been gone about 2 hours. They would be home by now, Beatrice with her suitcase unpacked, going out into her garden and taking up her ordinary routine, and Giles preparing for his match, renewing the whipping on his bat. In the afternoon, Beatrice would change into a cool frock and a shady hat and watch Giles play cricket. They would have tea afterwards in a tent, Giles very hot and red in the face, Beatrice laughing and talking to her friends. "Yes, we went over for the dance at Manderley. It was great fun.
I wonder Giles was able to run a yard.
Smiling at Giles, patting him on the back. They were both middle-aged and unromantic. They had been married for 20 years and had a grown-up son who was going to Oxford. They were very happy. Their marriage was a success. It had not failed after 3 months, as mine had done. I could not go on sitting in my bedroom any longer. The maids would want to come and do the room. Perhaps Clarice would not have noticed about Maxim's bed after all. I rumpled it to make it look as though he had slept there. I did not want the housemaids to know, if Clarice had not told them. I had a bath and dressed and went downstairs. The men had taken up the floor already in the hall, and the flowers had been carried away. The music stands were gone from the gallery. The band must have caught an early train. The gardeners were sweeping the lawns and the drive, clear of the spent fireworks. Soon there would be no trace left of the fancy dress ball at Manderley. How long the preparations had seemed, and how short and swift the clearance now. I remembered the salmon lady standing by the drawing-room door with her plate of chicken, and it seemed to me a thing I must have fancied, or something that had happened very long ago. Robert was polishing the table in the dining-room. He was normal again, stolid, dull, not the fey excited creature of the past few weeks. "Good morning, Robert," I said.
"Good morning, madam.
Have you seen Mr. de Winter anywhere?"
"He went out soon after breakfast, madam, before Major and Mrs. Lacey were down. He's not been in since."
"You don't know where he went?"
"No, madam, I could not say."
I wandered back again into the hall. I went through the drawing-room to the morning-room. Jasper rushed at me and licked my hands in a frenzy of delight, as if I had been away for a long time. He had spent the evening on Clarice's bed, and I had not seen him since tea-time yesterday. Perhaps the hours had been as long for him as they had for me. I picked up the telephone and asked for the number of the estate office. Perhaps Maxim was with Frank. I felt I must speak to him, even if it was only for 2 minutes. I must explain to him that I had not meant to do what I had done last night. Even if I never spoke to him again, I must tell him that. The clerk answered the telephone and told me that Maxim was not there.
"Mr. Crawley is here, Mrs. de Winter," said the clerk. "Would you speak to him?"
I would have refused, but he gave me no chance, and before I could put down the receiver, I heard Frank's voice.
"Is anything the matter?"
It was a funny way to begin a conversation, the thought flashed through my mind. He did not say good morning, or did you sleep well? Why did he ask if something was the matter? "Frank, it's me," I said. "Where's Maxim?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen him. He's not been in this morning."
"Not been to the office?"
"No."
Oh, well, it doesn't matter."
"Did you see him at breakfast?" Frank said.
"No, I did not get up."
"How did he sleep?"
I hesitated. Frank was the only person I did not mind knowing. He did not come to bed last night. There was silence at the other end of the line, as though Frank was thinking hard for an answer.
"Oh," he said at last, very slowly. "Oh, I see."
And then, after a minute,
"I was afraid something like that would happen."
"Frank," I said desperately, "what did he say last night when everyone had gone? What did you all do?"
"I had a sandwich with Giles and Mrs. Lacey," said Frank. "Maxim did not come. He made some excuse and went into the library. I came back home almost at once. Perhaps Mrs. Lacey can tell you."
"She's gone," I said. "They went after breakfast. She sent up a note. She had not seen Maxim," she said.
"Oh," said Frank.
I did not like it. I did not like the way he said it. It was sharp, ominous.
I slammed down the receiver and got up from the writing desk. I did not want to see Frank. He could not help me over this.
No one could help me but myself. My face was red and blotchy from crying. I walked about the room, biting the corner of my handkerchief, tearing at the edge. The feeling was strong within me that I should never see Maxim again. It was certainty, born of some strange instinct. He had gone away and would not come back. I knew in my heart that Frank believed this too, and would not admit it to me on the telephone. He did not want to frighten me. If I rang him up again at the office now, I should find that he had gone. The clerk would say, "Mr. Crawley has just gone out, Mrs. de Winter," and I could see Frank, hatless, climbing into his small, shabby Morris, driving off in search of Maxim. I went and stared out of the window at the little clearing where the satyr played his pipes. The rhododendrons were all over now. They would not bloom again for another year. The tall shrubs looked dark and drab now that the colour had gone. A fog was rolling up from the sea, and I could not see the woods beyond the bank. It was very hot, very oppressive. I could imagine our guests of last night saying to one another, "What a good thing this fog kept off for yesterday. We should never have seen the fireworks." I went out of the morning room and through the drawing room to the terrace. The sun had gone in now behind a wall of mist. It was as though a blight had fallen upon Manderley, taking the sky away and the light of the day. One of the gardeners passed me with a barrow full of bits of paper and litter and the skins of fruit left on the lawns by the people last night. "Good morning," I said.
"Good morning, madam."
"I'm afraid the ball last night has made a lot of work for you," I said.
"That's all right, madam," he said. "I think everyone enjoyed themselves, good and hearty, and that's the main thing, isn't it?"
"Yes, I suppose so," I said. He looked across the lawns to the clearing in the woods where the valley sloped to the sea. The dark trees loomed thin and indistinct.
"It's coming up very thick," he said.
"Yes," I said.
"A good thing it wasn't like this last night," he said.
"Yes," I said. He waited a moment, and then he touched his cap and went off trundling his barrow. I went across the lawns to the edge of the woods. The mist in the trees had turned to moisture and dripped upon my bare head like a thin rain. Jasper stood by my feet, dejected, his tail downcast, his pink tongue hanging from his mouth. The clammy oppression of the day made him listless and heavy. I could hear the sea from where I stood, sullen and slow, as it broke in the coves below the woods. The white fog rolled on past me towards the house, smelling of damp salt and seaweed. I put my hand on Jasper's coat. It was wringing wet. When I looked back at the house, I could not see the chimneys or the contour of the walls. I could only see the vague substance of the house, the windows in the west wing, and the flower tubs on the terrace. The shutter had been pulled aside from the window of the large bedroom in the west wing, and someone was standing there, looking down upon the lawns. The figure was shadowy and indistinct, and for one moment of shock and fear I believed it to be Maxim. Then the figure moved. I saw the arm reach up to fold the shutter, and I knew it was Mrs. Danvers. She had been watching me as I stood at the edge of the woods, bathed in that white wall of fog. She had seen me walk slowly from the terrace to the lawns. She may have listened to my conversation with Frank on the telephone from the connecting line in her own room. She would know that Maxim had not been with me last night. She would have heard my voice, known about my tears. She knew the part I had played through the long hours, standing by Maxim's side in my blue dress at the bottom of the stairs, and that he had not looked at me nor spoken to me. She knew, because she had meant it to happen. This was her triumph, hers and Rebecca's. I thought of her as I had seen her last night, watching me through the open door to the west wing, and that diabolical smile on her white skull's face, and I remembered that she was a living, breathing woman like myself. She was made of flesh and blood. She was not dead, like Rebecca. I could speak to her, but I could not speak to Rebecca. I walked back across the lawns on sudden impulse to the house. I went through the hall and up the great stairs. I turned in under the archway by the gallery. I passed through the door to the west wing, and so along the dark, silent corridor to Rebecca's room. I turned the handle of the door and went inside. Mrs. Danvers was still standing by the window, and the shutter was folded back. "Mrs. Danvers," I said. "Mrs. Danvers." She turned to look at me, and I saw her eyes were red and swollen with crying, even as mine were, and there were dark shadows in her white face.
"What is it?" she said. And her voice was thick and muffled from the tears she had shed, even as mine had been.
I had not expected to find her so. I had pictured her smiling as she had smiled last night, cruel and evil. Now she was none of these things. She was an old woman who was ill and tired. I hesitated, my hand still on the knob of the open door, and I did not know what to say to her now or what to do. She went on staring at me with those red, swollen eyes, and I could not answer her.
I left the menu on the desk, as usual, she said. Do you want something changed?
Her words gave me courage, and I left the door and came to the middle of the room. Mrs. Danvers, I said, I have not come to talk about the menu. You know that, don't you? She did not answer me. Her left hand opened and shut. You've done what you wanted, haven't you? I said. You meant this to happen, didn't you? Are you pleased now? Are you happy? She turned her head away and looked out of the window as she had done when I first came into the room.
Why did you ever come here, she said. Nobody wanted you at Manderley. We were all right until you came. Why did you not stay where you were out in France?
You seem to forget I love Mr. de Winter, I said.
If you loved him, you would never have married him, she said.
I did not know what to say. The situation was mad, unreal. She kept talking in that choked, muffled way, with her head turned from me.
I thought I hated you, but I don't now, she said. It seems to have spent itself, all the feeling I had.
Why should you hate me, I asked. What have I ever done to you that you should hate me?
You tried to take Mrs. de Winter's place, she said.
Still she would not look at me. She stood there sullen, her head turned from me. I had nothing changed, I said. Manderley went on as it had always been. I gave no orders. I left everything to you. I would have been friends with you if you had let me, but you set yourself against me from the first. I saw it in your face the moment I shook hands with you. She did not answer, and her hand kept opening and shutting against her dress. Many people marry twice, men and women, I said. There are thousands of second marriages taking place every day. You talk as though my marrying Mr. de Winter was a crime, a sacrilege against the dead. Haven't we as much right to be happy as anyone else?
Mr. de Winter is not happy, she said, turning to look at me at last. Any fool can see that. You have only to look at his eyes. He's still in hell, and he's looked like that ever since she died.
It's not true, I said. It's not true. He was happy when we were in France together. He was younger, much younger, and laughing and gay.
Well, he's a man, isn't he, she said. No man denies himself on a honeymoon, does he? Mr. de Winter's not 46 yet.
She laughed contemptuously and shrugged her shoulders.
How dare you speak to me like that? How dare you, I said.
I was not afraid of her any more. I went up to her, shook her by the arm. You made me wear that dress last night, I said. I should never have thought of it but for you. You did it because you wanted to hurt Mr. de Winter. You wanted to make him suffer. Hasn't he suffered enough without your playing that vile, hideous joke upon him? Do you think his agony and pain will bring Mrs. de Winter back again? She shook herself clear of me. The angry colour flooded her dead white face.
What do I care for his suffering, she said. He's never cared about mine. How do you think I've liked it watching you sit in her place, walk in her footsteps, touch the things that were hers? What do you think it's meant to me all these months, knowing that you wrote at her desk in the morning room, using the very pen that she used, speaking down the house telephone where she used to speak every morning of her life to me, ever since she first came to Manderley? What do you think it meant to me to hear Frith and Robert and the rest of the servants talking about you as Mrs. de Winter. Mrs. de Winter has gone out for a walk. Mrs. de Winter wants the car this afternoon at 3 o'clock. Mrs. de Winter won't be in to tea till 5 o'clock. And all the while, my Mrs. de Winter, my lady with her smile and her lovely face and brave ways, the real Mrs. de Winter, lying dead and cold and forgotten in the church crypt. If he suffers, then he deserves to suffer, marrying a young girl like you not 10 months afterwards. Well, he's paying for it now, isn't he? I've seen his face, I've seen his eyes. He's made his own hell, and there's no one but himself to thank for it. He knows she sees him. He knows she comes by night and watches him, and she doesn't come kindly. Not she, not my lady. She was never one to stand mute and still and be wronged. I'll see them in hell, Danny, she'd say. I'll see them in hell first. That's right, my dear, I tell her. No one will put upon you. You were born into this world to take what you could out of it, and she did. She didn't care. She wasn't afraid. She had all the courage and spirit of a boy, had my Mrs. de Winter. She ought to have been a boy. I often told her that. I had the care of her as a child. You knew that, didn't you?
No, I said. No, Mrs. Danvers, what's the use of all this? I don't want to hear any more. I don't want to know. Haven't I got feelings as well as you? Can't you understand what it means to me to hear her mentioned, to stand here and listen while you tell me about her? She did not hear me. She went on raving like a mad woman, a fanatic, her long fingers twisting and tearing the black stuff of her dress. She was lovely then, she said, lovely as a picture. Men turning to stare at her when she passed, and she not 12 years old, she knew then. She used to wink at me, like the little devil she was. I'm going to be a beauty, aren't I, Danny, she said. And we'll see about that, my love, we'll see about that, I told her. She had all the knowledge then of a grown person. She'd enter into conversation with men and women as clever and full of tricks as someone of 18. She twisted her father round her little finger, and she'd have done the same with her mother had she lived. Spirit! You couldn't beat my lady for spirit! She drove a 4 in hand on her 14th birthday, and her cousin, Mr. Jack, got up on the box beside her and tried to take the reins from her hands. They fought it out there together for 3 minutes, like a couple of wild cats and the horses galloping to glory. She won, though. My lady won. She cracked her whip over his head, and down he came, head over heels, cursing and laughing. They were a pair, I tell you, she and Mr. Jack. They sent him in the Navy, but he wouldn't stand the discipline, and I don't blame him. He had too much spirit to obey orders, like my lady. I watched her. Fascinated, horrified. A queer, ecstatic smile was on her lips, making her older than ever, making her skull's face vivid and real. No one got the better of her. Never, never, she said. She did what she liked. She lived as she liked. She had the strength of a little lion, too. I remember her at 16 getting up on one of her father's horses, a big brute of an animal, too, that the groom said was too hot for her to ride. She stuck to him all right. I can see her now with her hair flying out behind her, slashing at him, drawing blood, digging the spurs into his side. And when she got off his back, he was trembling all over, full of froth and blood. That will teach him, won't it, Danny, she said, and walked off to wash her hands as cool as you please. And that's how she went at life when she grew up. I saw her. I was with her. She cared for nothing and for no one. And then she was beaten in the end. But it wasn't a man. It wasn't a woman. The sea got her. The sea was too strong for her. The sea got her in the end. She broke off, her mouth working strangely and dragging at the corners. She began to cry noisily, harshly, her mouth open, and her eyes dry. "Mrs. Danvers," I said. "Mrs. Danvers." I stood before her, helplessly, not knowing what to do. I mistrusted her no longer. I was afraid of her no more. But the sight of her sobbing there, dry-eyed, made me shudder, made me ill. "Mrs. Danvers," I said, "you're not well. You ought to be in bed. Why don't you go to your room and rest? Why don't you go to bed?" She turned on me fiercely. "Leave me alone, can't you?" she said. "What's it to do with you if I show my grief? I'm not ashamed of it. I don't shut myself up in my room to cry. I don't walk up and down in my room like Mr. De Winter with the door locked on me." "What do you mean?" I said. "Mr. De Winter does not do that."
"He did," she said, "after she died. Up and down in the library. I heard him. I watched him, too, through the keyhole more than once. Backwards and forwards, like an animal in a cage."
"I don't want to hear," I said. "I don't want to know."
"And then you say you made him happy on his honeymoon," she said. "Made him happy, you, a young, ignorant girl, young enough to be his daughter. What do you know about life? What do you know about men? You come here and think you can take Mrs. De Winter's place. You take my lady's place. Why, even the servants laughed at you when you came to Manderley. Even the little scullery maid you met in the back passage there on your first morning. I wonder what Mr. De Winter thought when he got you back here at Manderley after his precious honeymoon was over. I wonder what he thought when he saw you sitting at the dining-room table for the first time."
"You'd better stop this, Mrs. Danvers," I said. "You'd better go to your room."
"Go to my room," she mimicked. "Go to my room. The mistress of the house thinks I'd better go to my room. And after that, what then? You'll go running to Mr. De Winter saying, 'Mrs. Danvers has been unkind to me. Mrs. Danvers has been rude.' You'll go running to him like you did before when Mr. Jack came to see me."
"I never told him," I said.
"That's a lie," she said. "Who else told him if you didn't? No one else was here. Frith and Robert were out and none of the other servants knew." "I made up my mind then. I'd teach you a lesson, and him, too. Let him suffer, I say. What do I care? What's his suffering to me? Why shouldn't I see Mr. Jack here at Manderley? He's the only link I have left now with Mrs. De Winter." "I'll not have him here," he said. "I'm warning you, it's the last time. He's not forgotten to be jealous, has he?"
I remembered crouching in the gallery when the library door was open. I remembered Maxim's voice raised in anger, using the words that Mrs. Danvers had just repeated. Jealous? Maxim jealous?
"He was jealous while she lived, and now he's jealous when she's dead," said Mrs. Danvers. "He forbids Mr. Jack the house now, like he did then. That shows you he's not forgotten her, doesn't it? Of course he was jealous. So was I. So was everyone who knew her. She didn't care. She only laughed. 'I shall live as I please, Danny,' she told me, 'and the whole world won't stop me.' A man had only to look at her once and be mad about her. I've seen them here, staying in the house. Men she'd meet up in London and bring for weekends. She would take them bathing from the boat. She would have a picnic supper at her cottage in the cove. They made love to her, of course. Who would not? She laughed. She would come back and tell me what they had said, what they'd done. She did not mind. It was like a game to her. Like a game. Who wouldn't be jealous? They were all jealous, all mad for her. Mr. De Winter, Mr. Jack, Mr. Crawley, everyone who knew her, everyone who came to Manderley."
"I don't want to know," I said. "I don't want to know." Mrs. Danvers came close to me. She put her face near to mine.
"It's no use, is it?" she said. "You'll never get the better of her. She's still mistress here, even if she is dead. She's the real Mrs. De Winter, not you. It's you that's the shadow and the ghost. It's you that's forgotten and not wanted and pushed aside. Well, why don't you leave Manderley to her? Why don't you go?"
I backed away from her towards the window, my old fear and horror rising up in me again. She took my arm and held it like a vice.
"Why don't you go?" she said. "We none of us want you. He doesn't want you. He never did. He can't forget her. He wants to be alone in the house again with her. It's you that ought to be lying there in the church crypt, not her. It's you who ought to be dead, not Mrs. De Winter."
She pushed me towards the open window. I could see the terrace below me, grey and indistinct in the white wall of fog.
"Look down there," she said.
"It's easy, isn't it? Why don't you jump? It wouldn't hurt, not to break your neck. It's a quick, kind way. It's not like drowning. Why don't you try it? Why don't you go?"
The fog filled the open window, damp and clammy. It stung my eyes. It clung to my nostrils. I held on to the windowsill with my hands.
"Don't be afraid," said Mrs. Danvers. "I won't push you. I won't stand by you. You can jump of your own accord. What's the use of your staying here at Manderley? You're not happy. Mr. De Winter doesn't love you. There's not much for you to live for, is there? Why don't you jump now and have done with it? Then you won't be unhappy any more."
I could see the flower tops on the terrace, and the blue of the hydrangeas clumped and solid. The paved stones were smooth and grey. They were not jagged and uneven. It was the fog that made them look so far away. They were not far, really. The window was not so very high.
"Why don't you jump?" whispered Mrs. Danvers. "Why don't you try?"
The fog came thicker than before, and the terrace was hidden from me. I could not see the flower tops any more, nor the smooth, paved stones. There was nothing but the white mist about me, smelling of seaweed, dank and chill. The only reality was the windowsill beneath my hands, and the grip of Mrs. Danvers on my left arm. If I jumped, I should not see the stones rise up to meet me. The fog would hide them from me. The pain would be sharp and sudden, as she said. The fall would break my neck. It would not be slow, like drowning. It would soon be over. And Maxim did not love me. Maxim wanted to be alone again, with Rebecca.
"Go on," whispered Mrs. Danvers. "Go on. Don't be afraid."
I shut my eyes. I was giddy from staring down at the terrace, and my fingers ached from holding to the ledge. The mist entered my nostrils and lay upon my lips, rank and sour. It was stifling like a blanket, like an anaesthetic. I was beginning to forget about being unhappy and about loving Maxim. I was beginning to forget Rebecca. Soon I would not have to think about Rebecca any more. As I relaxed my hands and sighed, the white mist and the silence that was part of it was shattered suddenly, was rent in two by an explosion that shook the window where we stood. The glass shivered in its frame. I opened my eyes. I stared at Mrs. Danvers. The burst was followed by another, and yet a third, and fourth. The sound of the explosion stung the air, and the birds rose unseen from the woods around the house and made an echo with their clamour. "What is it?" I said stupidly. "What has happened?" Mrs. Danvers relaxed her grip upon my arm. She stared out of the window into the fog. "It's the rockets," she said. "There must be a ship gone ashore there in the bay." We listened, staring into the white fog together, and then we heard the sound of footsteps running on the terrace beneath us. Chapter 19. It was Maxim. I could not see him, but I could hear his voice. He was shouting for Frith as he ran. I heard Frith answer from the hall and come out on the terrace. Their figures loomed out of the mist beneath us.
"She's ashore, all right," said Maxim. "I was watching her from the headland, and I saw her come right into the bay and head for the reef. They'll never shift her, not with these tides. She must have mistaken the bay for Kerith Harbour. It's like a wall out there in the bay. Tell them in the house to stand by with food and drink in case these fellows want anything, and ring through to the office to Mr. Crawley and tell him what's happened. I'm going back to the cove to see if I can do anything. Get me some cigarettes, will you?"
Mrs. Danvers drew back from the window. Her face was expressionless once more, the cold white mask that I knew. "We had better go down," she said. "Frith will be looking for me to make arrangements. Mr. De Winter may bring the men back to the house, as he said. Be careful of your hands. I'm going to shut the window." I stepped back into the room, still dazed and stupid, not sure of myself or of her. I watched her close the window and fasten the shutters and draw the curtains in their place. "It's a good thing there's no sea running," she said. "There wouldn't have been much chance for them then, but on a day like this there's no danger. The owners will lose their ship, though, if she's run on the reef, as Mr. De Winter said." She glanced round the room to make certain that nothing was disarranged or out of place. She straightened the cover on the double bed. Then she went to the door and held it open for me. "I will tell them in the kitchen to serve cold lunch in the dining room after all," she said, "and then it won't matter what time you come for it. Mr. De Winter may not want to rush back at 1 o'clock if he's busy down there in the cove." I stared at her blankly, and then passed out of the open door, stiff and wooden like a dummy. "When you see Mr. De Winter, madam, will you tell him it will be quite all right if he wants to bring the men back from the ship? There will be a hot meal ready for them any time." "Yes," I said. "Yes, Mrs. Danvers." She turned her back on me and went along the corridor to the service staircase, a weird, gaunt figure in her black dress, the skirt just sweeping the ground like the full wide skirts of 30 years ago. Then she turned the corner of the corridor and disappeared. I walked slowly along the passage to the door by the archway, my mind still blunt and slow, as though I had just woken from a long sleep. I pushed through the door and went down the stairs with no set purpose before me. Frith was crossing the hall towards the dining room. When he saw me, he stopped and waited until I came down into the hall. "Mr. De Winter was in a few minutes ago, madam," he said. "He took some cigarettes and then went back again to the beach. It appears there's a ship gone ashore." "Yes," I said. "Did you hear the rockets, madam?" said Frith. "Yes, I heard the rockets," I said. "I was in the pantry with Robert, and we both thought at first that one of the gardeners had let off a firework left over from last night," said Frith. "And I said to Robert, 'What do they want to do that for in this weather? Why don't they keep them for the kiddies on Saturday night?' And then the next one came, and then the third." "That's not fireworks," says Robert. "That's a ship in distress." "I believe you're right," I said. And I went out to the hall, and there was Mr. De Winter calling me from the terrace. "Yes," I said. "Well, it's hardly to be wondered at in this fog, madam. That's what I said to Robert just now. It's difficult to find your way on the road, let alone on the water." "Yes," I said. "If you want to catch Mr. De Winter, he went straight across the lawn only 2 minutes ago," said Frith. "Thank you, Frith," I said. I went out on the terrace. I could see the trees taking shape beyond the lawns. The fog was lifting. It was rising in little clouds to the sky above. It whirled above my head in wreaths of smoke. I looked up at the windows above my head. They were tightly closed, and the shutters were fastened. They looked as though they would never open, never be thrown wide. It was by the large window in the centre that I had stood 5 minutes before. How high it seemed above my head, how lofty and remote. The stones were hard and solid under my feet. I looked down at my feet and then up again to the shuttered window, and as I did so, I became aware suddenly that my head was swimming, and I felt hot. A little trickle of perspiration ran down the back of my neck. Black dots jumped about in the air in front of me. I went into the hall again and sat down on a chair. My hands were quite wet. I sat very still, holding my knees. "Frith," I called. "Frith, are you in the dining room?" "Yes, madam." He came out at once and crossed the hall towards me. "Don't think me very odd, Frith, but I rather think I'd like a small glass of brandy."
"Certainly, madam."
I went on holding my knees and sitting very still. He came back with a liqueur glass on a silver salver.
"Do you feel a trifle unwell, madam?" said Frith. "Would you like me to call Clarice?"
"No, I'll be all right, Frith," I said. "I felt a bit hot, that's all."
"It's a very warm morning, madam, very warm indeed. Oppressive, one might almost say."
"Yes, Frith, very oppressive." I drank the brandy and put the glass back on the silver salver.
"Perhaps the sound of those rockets alarmed you," said Frith. "They went off so very sudden."
"Yes, they did," I said.
"And what with the hot morning and standing about all last night, you're not perhaps feeling quite like yourself, madam," said Frith.
"No, perhaps not," I said. "Will you lie down for half an hour? It's quite cool in the library." "No. No, I think I'll go out in a moment or two. Don't bother, Frith."
"No. Very good, madam."
He went away and left me alone in the hall. It was quiet sitting there. Quiet and cool. All trace of the party had been cleared away. It might never have happened. The hall was as it had always been, grey and silent and austere, with the portraits and the weapons on the wall. I could scarcely believe that last night I had stood there in my blue dress at the bottom of the stairs, shaking hands with 500 people. I could not believe that there had been music stands in the minstrel's gallery, and a band playing there, a man with a fiddle, a man with a drum. I got up and went out onto the terrace again. The fog was rising, lifting to the tops of the trees. I could see the woods at the end of the lawns. Above my head a pale sun tried to penetrate the heavy sky. It was hotter than ever, oppressive, as Frith had said. A bee hummed by me in search of scent, bumbling, noisy, and then creeping inside a flower was suddenly silent. On the grass banks above the lawns the gardener started his mowing machine. A startled linnet fled from the whirring blades towards the rose garden. The gardener bent to the handles of the machine and walked slowly along the bank, scattering the short-tipped grass and the pinpoint daisy heads. The smell of the sweet warm grass came towards me on the air, and the sun shone down upon me full and strong from out of the white mist. I whistled for Jasper, but he did not come. Perhaps he had followed Maxim when he went down to the beach. I glanced at my watch. It was after 12:30, nearly 12:40. This time yesterday, Maxim and I were standing with Frank in the little garden in front of his house, waiting for his housekeeper to serve lunch. 24 hours ago. They were teasing me, baiting me about my dress. "You'll both get the surprise of your lives," I had said. I felt sick with shame at the memory of my words. And then I realized, for the first time, that Maxim had not gone away as I had feared. The voice I had heard on the terrace was calm and practical, the voice I knew, not the voice of last night when I stood at the head of the stairs. Maxim had not gone away. He was down there in the cove somewhere. He was himself, normal and sane. He had just been for a walk, as Frank had said. He had been on the headland. He had seen the ship closing in towards the shore. All my fears were without foundation. Maxim was safe. Maxim was all right. I had just experienced something that was degrading and horrible and mad, something that I did not fully understand even now, that I had no wish to remember, that I wanted to bury for evermore deep in the shadows of my mind with old forgotten terrors of childhood. But even this did not matter, as long as Maxim was all right. Then I, too, went down the steep, twisting path, through the dark woods, to the beach below. The fog had almost gone, and when I came to the cove, I could see the ship at once, lying about 2 miles offshore, with her bows pointed towards the cliffs. I went along the breakwater and stood at the end of it, leaning against the rounded wall. There was a crowd of people on the cliffs already, who must have walked along the coastguard path from Kerith. The cliffs and the headland were part of Manderley, but the public had always used the right-of-way along the cliffs. Some of them were scrambling down the cliff face to get a closer view of the stranded ship. She lay at an awkward angle, her stern tilted, and there were a number of rowing boats already pulling round her. The lifeboat was standing off. I saw someone stand up in her and shout through a megaphone. I could not hear what he was saying. It was still misty out in the bay, and I could not see the horizon. Another motorboat chugged into the light with some men aboard. The motorboat was dark grey. I could see someone in uniform. That would be the harbour master from Kerith, and the Lloyd's agent with him. Another motorboat followed, a party of holiday makers from Kerith aboard. They circled round and round the stranded steamer, chatting excitedly. I could hear their voices echoing across the still water. I left the breakwater and the cove and climbed up the path over the cliffs towards the rest of the people. I did not see Maxim anywhere. Frank was there, talking to one of the coast guards. I hung back when I saw him, momentarily embarrassed. Barely an hour ago I had been crying to him down the telephone. I was not sure what I ought to do. He saw me at once and waved his hand. I went over to him and the coast guard. The coast guard knew me.
"Come to see the fun, Mrs. de Winter," he said, smiling. "I'm afraid it will be a hard job. The tugs may shift her, but I doubt it. She's hard and fast where she is on that ledge."
"What will they do?" I said.
"They'll send a diver down directly to see if she's broken her back," he replied. "There's the fellow there in the red stocking cap. Like to see through these glasses?"
I took his glasses and looked at the ship. I could see a group of men staring over her stern. One of them was pointing at something. The man in the lifeboat was still shouting through the megaphone. The harbour master from Kerith had joined the group of men in the stern of the stranded ship. The diver, in his stocking cap, was sitting in the grey motorboat belonging to the harbour master. The pleasure boat was still circling round the ship. A woman was standing up, taking a snapshot. A group of gulls had settled on the water and were crying foolishly, hoping for scraps. I gave the glasses back to the coast guard. "Nothing seems to be happening," I said.
"They'll send him down directly," said the coast guard. "They'll argue a bit first, like all foreigners. Here come the tugs."
"They'll never do it," said Frank. "Look at the angle she's lying at. It's much shallower there than I thought."
"That reef runs out quite a way," said the coast guard. "You don't notice it in the ordinary way, going over that piece of water in a small boat, but a ship with her depth would touch all right."
"I was down in the first cove by the valley when they fired the rocket," said Frank. "I could scarcely see 3 yards in front of me where I was, and then the things went off out of the blue." I thought how alike people were in a moment of common interest. Frank was Frith all over again. giving his version of the story, as though it mattered, as though we cared. I knew that he had gone down to the beach to look for Maxim. I knew that he had been frightened, as I had been. And now all this was forgotten and put aside, our conversation down the telephone, our mutual anxiety, his insistence that he must see me, all because a ship had gone ashore in the fog. A small boy came running up to us. "Will the sailors be drowned?" he asked.
"Not them. They're all right, sonny," said the Coast Guard. "The sea's as flat as the back of my hand. No one's going to be hurt this time."
"If it had happened last night, we should never have heard them," said Frank. "We must have let off more than 50 rockets at our show, beside all the smaller things."
"We'd have heard all right," said the Coast Guard. "We'd have seen the flash and known the direction. There's the diver, Mrs. De Winter. See him putting on his helmet?"
"I want to see the diver," said the small boy.
"There he is," said Frank, bending and pointing. "That chap there, putting on the helmet. They're going to lower him into the water."
"Won't he be drowned?" said the child.
"Divers don't drown," said the Coast Guard. "They have air pumped into them all the time. Watch him disappear. There he goes."
The surface of the water was disturbed a minute, and then was clear again.
"He's gone," said the small boy.
"Where's Maxim?" I said.
"He's taken one of the crew into Kerith," said Frank. "The fellow lost his head and jumped for it, apparently, when the ship struck. We found him clinging on to one of the rocks here under the cliff. He was soaked to the skin, of course, and shaking like a jelly. Couldn't speak a word of English, of course. Maxim went down to him and found him bleeding like a pig from a scratch on the rocks. He spoke to him in German. Then he hailed one of the motorboats from Kerith that was hanging around like a hungry shark, and he's gone off with him to get him bandaged by a doctor. If he's lucky, he'll just catch old Philip sitting down to lunch."
"When did he go?" I said.
"He went just before you turned up," said Frank, "about 5 minutes ago. I wonder you didn't see the boat. He was sitting in the stern with this German fellow."
"He must have gone while I was climbing up the cliff," I said.
"Maxim is splendid at anything like this," said Frank. "He always gives a hand, if he can. You'll find he will invite the whole crew back to Manderley and feed them, and give them beds into the bargain." "That's right," said the Coast Guard. "He'd give the coat off his back for any of his own people, I know that. I wish there was more like him in the county."
"Yes, we could do with them," said Frank. We went on staring at the ship. The tugs were standing off still, but the lifeboat had turned and gone back towards Kerith.
"It's not their turn today," said the Coast Guard.
"No," said Frank,
"and I don't think it's a job for the tugs either. It's the shipbreaker who's going to make money this time."
The gulls wheeled overhead, mewing like hungry cats. Some of them settled on the ledges of the cliff, while others, bolder, rode the surface of the water beside the ship. The Coast Guard took off his cap and mopped his forehead.
"Seems kind of airless, doesn't it?" he said.
"Yes," I said. The pleasure boat with the camera people went chugging off towards Kerith.
"They've got fed up," said the Coast Guard.
"I don't blame them," said Frank. "I don't suppose anything will happen for hours. The diver will have to make his report before they try to shift her."
"That's right," said the Coast Guard.
"I don't think there's much sense in hanging about here," said Frank. "We can't do anything. I want my lunch." I did not say anything. He hesitated. I felt his eyes upon me. "What are you going to do?" he said. "I think I shall stay here a bit," I said. "I can have lunch any time. It's cold. It doesn't matter. I want to see what the diver's going to do." Somehow I could not face Frank just at the moment. I wanted to be alone, or with someone I did not know, like the Coast Guard.
"You won't see anything," said Frank. "There won't be anything to see. Why not come back and have some lunch with me?"
"No," I said. "No, really."
"Oh, well," said Frank, "you know where to find me if you do want me. I shall be at the office all the afternoon."
"All right," I said. He nodded to the Coast Guard and went off down the cliff towards the cove. I wondered if I had offended him. I could not help it. All these things would be settled some day. One day. So much seemed to have happened since I spoke to him on the telephone, and I did not want to think about anything any more. I just wanted to sit there on the cliff and stare at the ship.
"He's a good sort, Mr. Crawley," said the Coast Guard.
"Yes," I said.
"He'd give his right hand for Mr. De Winter, too," he said.
"Yes, I think he would," I said. The small boy was still hopping around on the grass in front of us.
"When's the diver coming up again?" he said.
"Not yet, sonny," said the Coast Guard.
A woman in a pink striped frock and a hairnet came across the grass towards us.
"Charlie! Charlie! Where are you?" she called.
"Here's your mother coming to give you what for," said the Coast Guard.
"I've seen the diver, Mum," shouted the boy.
The woman nodded to us and smiled. She did not know me. She was a holidaymaker from Kerith.
"The excitement all seems to be over, doesn't it?" she said.
"They're saying down on the cliff there, the ship will be there for days."